From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Happy New Year. And we could perhaps use some. 2020 begins with the prospect of an historic impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate and ended yesterday, 2019 did, with throat-catching images of an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, a country where so much blood and treasure has been spent. We're going to be talking about the impossible impeachment trial elsewhere in the program, but let's start by broadening out the lens to global security. In Baghdad today, American troops fired tear gas at hundreds of Iranian-backed militiamen and other protesters who gathered outside the U.S. embassy for a second day. They are angry about U.S. airstrikes last weekend in Iraq and Syria that killed more than two dozen Iraqi fighters in these Iranian-backed militias. The U.S. says the airstrikes were in retaliation for an attack last week that killed an American contractor in Iraq. There are also some new ominous words from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, speaking to a meeting of Communist Party leaders yesterday. He warned of unspecified, shocking action over stalled nuclear talks with the U.S. President Trump responded at a New Year's Eve celebration at Mar-a-Lago last night.
He likes me. I like him. We get along. He's representing his country. I'm representing my country. We have to do what we have to do. But he did sign a contract. He did sign an agreement talking about denuclearization. And that was signed, number one sentence, denuclearization. That was done in Singapore. And I think he's a man of his word, so we're going to find out. But
Let's bring in Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. He's here in the studio with us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It certainly looks like it's going to come in with a bang, so to speak.
Well, and they all do lately, don't they? Go in and out. But the comments from the president remind me of how this year started with that meeting with Kim Jong-un.
Yes.
You know, the past year started. Your thoughts on hearing the president with the same kind of language that he's been applauded for from his backers who say, yeah, talk to him like, you know, guy to guy.
Right.
And others who say you cannot talk to the leader of Kim Jong of North Korea as if he's your pal.
Yeah. Well, I think we can separate these two things out. I've been a supporter of diplomacy with North Korea. I welcome the president's initiative when this all began way back when in Singapore. It's sort of come off the rails, but I certainly agree with critics who say, you know, Kim Jong-un is not going to make decisions based on whether he's a pal with someone or not. Mm. He's using the leverage he has to try to get what he wants out of the president. My suspicion is that North Korea feels like it has some leverage, that it can cause some mischief in an election year, and that might force Trump to, make some concessions. I wonder, though, if the North Koreans are not have maybe an exaggerated sense of their leverage here. But that's where we're at. Loyal Here and Now listeners will remember that a month ago we talked
about
North Korea.
They're all loyal. They're all loyal.
Of course they are. Well, the new ones, they'll remember that we talked about this. And we said a month ago, something's going to happen. We're going to have a missile launch. Maybe it's a satellite launch. Maybe it's an ICBM test. Maybe it's a nuclear test. But something's going to happen. And lo and behold, 30 days later, whatever it's been, all the signs are in that direction.
And so with his new comments, how do you interpret them? What do you think it might be?
I think the smart money right now is on a satellite launch. What I expect is the following. There's going to be a series of provocations. You start on the lowest rung first, and then you move up. So the lowest rung would be North Korea claiming that it is sending a satellite into space and using a rocket very similar but not exactly the same as an intercontinental ballistic missile to do that. Now, they're not supposed to do that. They know it would be provocative, but that's the first rung. The second rung after that, in terms of escalation, is firing a military missile, testing an ICBM, firing something near Japan. The third is a nuclear test, and then I don't think it would ever get to this point, but it is certainly possible the final and most serious provocation, if we continue down this route, would be an above-ground nuclear test or an above-ocean nuclear test.
Well, and, of course, people on the west coast of the United States are also worried that Kim Jong-un might want to demonstrate the distance that he can go with a missile. But, talk about where we are. The nuclear talks with him have stalled.
Yes.
The idea that President Trump said he said denuclearization, I don't think a lot of people thought that was imminent. And he wants the U.S. to lift economic sanctions. Economic sanctions play out in a lot of our global relations. The Trump administration, they're not likely to do that unless there's denuclearization. So we're caught in this web here. Where do you think the negotiating can be?
Well, here, let's start with the big picture. I actually think that both sides want to get something done. So in that big speech that Kim gave yesterday, or today by, you know, time difference, he left open the door for diplomacy. And he hasn't pulled the trigger on the most provocative things. And if he starts low and moves up the ladder of provocation, that is also an indicator he's trying to push Trump to get a deal that's more favorable to him. I think what we have is a situation where North Korea sees Mr. Trump as weak. They're trying to squeeze as much as they can to get something. They probably feel that they can get a better deal with him than his successor if he is not reelected. But they also don't want to push this to the point where it sort of spins out of control. So I think we'll see continued provocations that are measured still with the open possibility of negotiation. And I think, you know, I've been predicting a third summit or whatever number we're on now. We may very well get that. But it will have to be a thing where all the agreements are made up front.
Okay.
He can't afford to fail. Neither side can afford to show up like they did in Hanoi and have the thing blow up on them.
Yeah. Let's turn to Baghdad, which of necessity means to Iran as well.
Yes. Parallel
stories at this point. The Pentagon now sending more Marines to the Middle East in response to the protests there, the attack on the American embassy, getting through at least one door and into the reception area, really frightening, reminds us of Iran 40 years ago and the storming of the embassy there in which hostages were taken. This all traces back to, you know, the reason that President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal is that he and his aides who felt that Iran... It's not that they weren't abiding by the nuclear deal. They were.
Correct.
But the thinking was that they were backing militias in the area, Hezbollah groups in the area. Now the president and the Pentagon feel that this was such a group that killed this American contractor that led to the airstrikes.
Yes.
Here's Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, on Morning Edition today.
I don't think there is any question at all. Kataib Hezbollah is well known to us. Now, they didn't materialize yesterday. They have been a long-term Iranian proxy in Iraq, so the Iranian hand here is not really concealed.
So they're saying that these are Iranian-backed militias made up of Iraqis that killed this American contractor. No question that it's Iraq it's Iran in Iraq.
I would say that's probably right. I mean, I don't have the smoking gun, but that sounds right to me. Let me make two points. One, I can't help but point out that when the nuclear agreement was enforced, there were no attacks on U.S. embassies by Iran or Iran proxies. The president pulled out of that deal promising we're going to get tough in Iran and Iran's going to back down. The opposite has occurred. We have more provocations, more problems now with Iran than we did during the agreement. So that didn't work out at all as predicted.
Well,
I just
want to jump in. Hold your thought. Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative, said the same thing yesterday. She said this is more broadly about American foreign policy. Let's listen.
You know, U.S. policy, it's like we don't see around the corners anymore. And it's really shocking that the United States would put its diplomats in this kind of jeopardy.
In other words, she drew the line also from breaking the nuclear deal and not understanding that might drive, different people into the arms of different people. And here we are.
Yes. Well, obviously, if you're going to try to choke a country to death, they're going to kick back. And
with
that's
the
what
sanctions,
we see.
The economic sanctions.
Yes, the sanctions. So we've seen this in a variety of ways. Attack on Saudi Arabians, oil fields, the drones, you know, lots of different things. Not surprising. It's surprising that we weren't prepared for it. I would have thought that we might have anticipated it. But I'm going to say something that other people aren't saying. I'm going to go offer a different point of view very quickly. And that is, I think this is mostly political theater. I don't think the Iranian militias, if they're at the direction of Iran, are looking to escalate so that there is a conflict. And I don't think the U.S. And the president, despite his constant bluster, is looking for a fight with Iran. So I think this is sort of political theater at a tactical level. In Iraq, the center of gravity, you know, people don't like Iran and Iraq, and Iraqis don't like the U.S. particularly, but the center of gravity is this big political, social movement in Iraq, all the protests. That's what's really driving Iraqi attitudes and Iraqi behavior, while the sideshow is the U.S. and Iran duking it out at a low level that both sides hope won't escalate, but tries to make the other look bad as each tries to put pressure on the other.
Okay. Well, hopefully, you know, no one accidentally shoots someone.
Exactly.
In that,
I mean, that's the risk, yeah, is you get inadvertent escalation.
We have a minute left. What are we not paying attention to that we should more in 2020?
Well, 2020, I'll certainly be looking at India and India's relationship with Pakistan. The Indian leader, Mr. Modi, apparently feels like he can act with impunity and do whatever he wants, and he's getting pushback at home, and there may be tensions with Pakistan as a result. I think also in China, you know, where is Hong Kong going? What is happening with the Uyghurs? There's a lot going on at a moment when perhaps Chinese economic growth may be hitting a bit of a decline. And then finally, I would say, and I just thought about this morning, you know, imagine if you're in you wake up, you know, in your home and you're of the Muslim faith and you look around the world and the Chinese are imprisoning Muslims. And all around the world, they are under the gun. And I think that's something to watch.
And shadow foreign policies. Jim Walsh, thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It's the beginning of a new year, so why not delve deep into the festive overture by Soviet-era composer Dmitri Shostakovich? It sounds like so much fun, right? It becomes triumphant in part, but it was probably for Shostakovich anything but. Let's explore that tension with our classical music opinionator, Fran Hoffner, who joins us from New York. Hi, Fran.
Hi there.
And you write in your article, your 2016 article about this, which we'll post at herenow.org, Shostakovich is very much your boy, your guy, your nervous little guy. Why? Why nervous?
I tend to prefer classical and romantic era music, but Shostakovich is probably the most modern composer I feel a lot of affection for, and his life was riddled with troubles by the Soviet state, and he was sort of made his music in constant terror of being defamed by the government.
Right, by Stalin and the Soviet state and the communists. And by the way, we just want to take a second to recommend author M.T. Anderson's incredible book about Shostakovich in Leningrad Under Siege. His book was Symphony for the City of the Dead. It's incredible. And in fact, here's a little bit of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony that you read about in that book. And so Fran Hoffner, he's writing at a time when he's under siege. There's a nervousness. As you say, this is why you have this kind of affection that Tumblr girls feel about Marvel characters or CW characters. Tell us more.
Oh, I just feel very protective over him. Wow, this was written back when Tumblr was really a website, more in the conversation. But I want him to be well. It's like hard to think of another composer whose life was so heavily affected by the government under which he lived. A lot of the other sort of communist-era Russian composers get out of Russia. Prokofiev gets out. Rachmaninoff gets out. They decide that they can't make their music under this kind of control, so they go to Central Europe, and Shostakovich stays, and therefore we don't really know what Shostakovich's music would be like without the state. It's so influenced by the state. And so I feel a little sad for him.
Yeah, and protective. Well, as you write, one of the most modern composers that you have this affection for, his life spanned most of the 20th century. I think he died in the 70s, the 1970s. And as you say, this puts him smack in the middle of every important thing to happen in a 20th century minus disco. So very much influenced by the world around him, and once was considered one of the great hope of new music in New Russia?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a composer who continues, who works not only through Stalin's reign, but afterwards, that he's able to maintain a career. He gets defamed twice, which for numerous composers under Soviet rule, like, they got one, and then they were, you know, disappeared or they were executed. And he manages to survive twice. He continues to work. By the end of his career, he's doing film scores. Like, he has a very sort of modern career.
Well, let's talk about the time when Stalin came to power. Widespread famine by the early 1930s. In 36, Stalin institutes the Great Purge of opponents and intellectuals. 1 million people imprisoned, at least 700,000 killed. And that year, Stalin goes to a performance of Shostakovich's opera Lady Macbeth. Let's listen. Okay, apparently Stalin did not like it, which is
Stalin
not...
hates it.
And what happens?
It's sort of a satire. It is a woman overthrowing her husband and master. It's maybe not the type of art, if you are a dictator, that you want to see. And so he defames Shostakovich, and Shostakovich essentially has to go into hiding for a little over a year after this.
Yeah, and he's only 30 years old.
I know, and that's to think, like, I'm a contemporary, I guess, of him at that age, and to think if I was defamed, I don't know that I would ever come out of hiding.
Well, he does in 1937. After seeing friends and relatives disappear or get executed, composers in this year essentially have to compose music that's positive and patriotic, or they risk losing their lives, as you said. And we come to Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. Here's the finale. Okay, we resolve. He had a resolve at the end, right?
Yeah, he did have to get there, but I think he holds right before that resolution just slightly too long, sort of like feigning a smile.
Right, right. Because, again, Stalin's listening. And if he thinks you're going to end on a dark note, on a dissonant note, that's not a good thing.
Absolutely not. And I think there's a lot of fear injected into the Fifth Symphony that he covers up with really triumphant resolutions like that in order as a kind of a misdirect.
Yeah. Well, but you say the same is true of the apparently misnamed festive overture, because it does sound festive, but let's listen and tell us what you're hearing. So fun, galloping maybe?
Yeah, a lot of fun.
But you hear what?
I mean, he wrote this in 3 days. To me, it feels like a rushed attempt at joy, which is part of what makes it fun as a listener. You're like, is he going to be able to like pull this off? Because it's so quick, it's so overwhelming. He's also kind of putting on a little show. There's a lot of humor to his music, which I think he had to have in order to survive all that he went through. And so Festive Overture also becomes one of his funnier pieces to me, because I don't know that he really cares about how festive it is.
And by the way, the Festive Overture composed in 1954, a year after Stalin died. So it sounds like there might almost be a little bit of manicness there.
Yeah, kind of a manic celebration, maybe, at the death of Stalin. But it's also written to commemorate an event that drastically changed Shostakovich's life, I think kind of for the worse, the October Revolution, you know?
Yeah. So you played this as a high school timpanist, and you loved, you say, this moment near the middle of the piece with the snare drum. Let's listen. How fun is that, given that much of the time you're waiting to play as a timpanist?
That snare piece is so much fun to listen to, because he's kind of giving over the piece to the snare drum, which never ever happens in classical music. Snare is sort of like an accessory for militaristic pieces, and so I think to hide the orchestra, the strings under the snare, is a really clever and funny thing, and also makes it seem that much more militaristic.
Yeah. So what happened to Shostakovich after Stalin's death, which I'm sure didn't end the terror that many people felt? Well, we see that he's getting a lot of attention lately. The BSO, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, is recording all 14 of his symphonies. What did the last chapter of his life, what was that like?
Well, by that point, he's doing some film scores. He has a sort of more, you know, modern career. He also joins the Communist Party, which is quite strange after all that he's been through, but he does sign up. And his legacy into the back half of the 20th century and even till now, I think, is pretty contentious because he writes his autobiography and he claims a lot of his work is meant to be interpreted as subversive, that he never agreed with Stalin. But it's very easy, I think, to retroactively say what one's work is. And there are a lot of people who doubt that about Shostakovich and who think that he was just very willing to go along with whatever the trends and desires were of the Soviet government in order to survive.
Well, while there might be some debate over Shostakovich, there doesn't seem to be any debate about his Symphony No. 7, which was written again for the besieged city of Leningrad. Seen as a tribute to the millions of Soviets who died in World War II and the city under siege. In fact, they played the symphony, they debuted it in these terrible circumstances, and the piece seemed to be a symbol of resistance to totalitarianism.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is so compelling about Shostakovich's music is that he had all of these complex ideas and that he really was a very political composer given the time and place that he lived. So he was allowed to create complicated subversive art and then also very straightforward symbolic art at the same time.
Well, and given the times, that would make him a very nervous composer.
Yeah. You'd be jittery too.
Right. Fran Hoffner, who writes about classical music for WQXR in New York. Fran, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Ohio has one of the largest Amish populations in the country, and many of the settlements are in rural counties where access to health care is scarce. So one project is bringing breast cancer screenings to Amish women, breast cancer being the leading cause of death among Amish women under 60. From WOSU, Paige Flager reports.
It's a typical mammogram room. If you went to a hospital, it would look exactly the same.
Honestly, Valerie Rice is a mammographer, and she's dressed like one, too. Her shirt is covered in pink breast cancer awareness ribbons.
It's nothing really different, except that it's in a moving vehicle.
This exam room is on wheels, a large coach bus, pink, of course. Today, it's parked outside a Mennonite church in Fredericksburg, Ohio, within a buggy ride's distance from some of the largest Amish settlements in the country.
Really what we like to say is like to bridge the gap between the culture of Amish and Mennonite communities and the culture of healthcare.
Melissa Thomas is the director of the Center for Appalachia Research in Cancer Education. She organizes mobile clinics like this one about 25 times a year.
We try to find screening locations that are in the most remote sections of the state that are serving more than likely a more conservative group of Amish that may not have access or availability into the local hospital systems.
The majority of Ohio's Amish settlements are in Appalachian counties, where cancers that can be detected by preventative testing occur at higher rates. There is little data available on the Amish, but Thomas says what she has found in her own research of Ohio settlements is startling.
And what was disturbing to us is that the leading cause of death of Amish women under the age of 60 was breast cancer.
Beyond distance, there are other reasons Amish women underutilize methods like mammograms. There's a language barrier. Some in the community are more comfortable speaking Dutch or German than English. And cost can be an impediment, too. The Amish don't participate in the health insurance market, instead pooling money for procedures in a group fund. Plus, many Amish women say they don't know what resources are available.
That was the way with me when I had my diagnosis. What do I do? Where do I go? You know, I felt like being out in the boonies about it.
Ella Miller is 80 years old, Amish, and a 30-year survivor of breast cancer. She's a community health worker with the project.
People think that a mammogram will cause cancer. It's very hard to get that out of their mind.
Research shows the majority of Amish women underestimate breast cancer risk and are more likely to believe that sort of myth. Miller says that makes it difficult to get women in the door. In a nearby county, a community health assessment found that about 60% of non-Amish residents had had mammograms, while only 20% of Amish women had. If they do receive positive test results, it can be even more difficult to encourage them to seek medical intervention.
There are some people that think that is meant to be, and that was God's plan in their life. And whenever their life ends, so be it.
She feels her mastectomy years ago gave her a chance to help other women in her community.
You should still do what needs to be done. Yes, God will help you, but you also have to do your part.
After a diagnosis, the project helps connect women with nearby hospital systems for further care. Then the mobile clinic rolls on to another settlement. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Will 2020 be the year of an historic third trial of an impeached American president? Right now, both sides of the aisle are fighting over how to go forward. Last night, President Trump repeated it's all a hoax, complaining he had no witnesses in the House impeachment. Of course, he held back subpoenaed witnesses. Douglas Brinkley is a presidential historian at Rice University, who's also made a few minutes for us today to scan the horizon and also adjust the rear view mirror. Douglas Brinkley, welcome back and Happy New Year.
Well, back at you. Happy New Year.
Well, and let's hope. You know, what do you think? And that's why we have you here. But first, look backwards. And as I said, that rearview mirror, you know, may need a little adjusting because it's so close. But how are you looking at 2019?
Well, it was a year of the investigation on Donald Trump. I mean, the early part of 2019, it was like a TikTok slow motion movie waiting to find out what the Mueller report would be. And ended up, if not exonerating Donald Trump, it didn't destroy his presidency in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, it kind of cocked up his hubris factor. And over the summer, he made the overture to Ukraine and started the investigation of Joe and Hunter Biden. I think history will see it as a showdown year, with the main lead characters being Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, Nancy Pelosi, and Mitch McConnell. There'll be four gold star named as people try to sift through what happened this year.
You know what else is interesting about that? None of them are, and I have great deference for those who've acquired wisdom through age, so I say this with that in mind, none of them are spring chickens. Isn't that interesting?
It is. It's the sort of last act of the baby boomers going on here. They've been feuding since the days of the Vietnam War. You know, there's a lot of revenge in the air. We've had the impeachment process of Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton and now Donald Trump. But, you know, I think a mistake I feel people make in 2019 was that they keep connecting what's happening to Donald Trump to Nixon and Watergate. But when Congress met in February of 1974, with that starting that impeachment process, it really was the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. You had a Democratic Senate. You had no Fox News or conservative media outlets. You had angry conservatives at Nixon because he had created the EPA and the Clean Air and Water Act and the like. Some people call Nixon the last New Deal president. And there was actually a crimes being committed in Watergate. So this is just a different kind of impeachment. It has nothing to do with Nixon. Yeah. It seems to me to be more like the Clinton fury of the 90s.
Well, except for the payback that you mentioned, because I think I can hear perhaps younger voices saying, what is he talking about? You are so right that there's this through line post-Watergate. We know that there were conservatives like William Kristol and Roger Ailes who joined forces and who said, we're going to create a brand new media. We're never going to let this happen again, meaning the Washington Post doing the reporting that helped take down their Republican president. And this has been a grudge match since then. And now you have people like President Trump's, one of his top consultants, Roger Stone, who has a tattoo of Nixon on his back. And there does seem to be in the culture this sense of we never got over the 60s.
Couldn't agree more. And I call it the long 60s, meaning there was a feeling that the U.S. Government was overreaching its bounds, that it was punishing corporate America to such a degree that they created a business roundtable and they started trying to create new ways to get their public policy messages out. In the 70s, you got the creation of the American Enterprise Institute and Heritage Foundation and Cato. And one could go on and on. And then, as I mentioned, the beginning of right-wing talk radio and a new, more aggressive conservatism that took hold during the Reagan years. Couple that with Citizens United and all this money going into politics, and we're at a constant war. There really are two Americas going on here.
Well, I'm going to jump in and say three, because I've been dying to ask William Kristol, and we hope we get the chance, how he feels about having been part of building the infrastructure of this, because now, of course, he is one of the conservatives who is very much appalled by the direction Donald Trump has taken the conservative movement in. And yet he helped lay the groundwork for that. I'm going to just ask you one last thing as we look back with an eye on the clock. You mentioned that the Mueller report at the beginning of the year didn't exonerate President Trump. But that's not the message that got out. And I just want to ask you about that, because Mueller very clearly said he couldn't clear him of charges of obstruction of justice and felt that it was up to the Congress to look at that. And then you had the president's attorney general, William Barr, come out and completely interpret the Mueller report in another way, to say it completely exonerated President Trump. Just as an historian, talk a little bit about what's been happening in the White House and this attorney general in particular. Is this something that you find resonates elsewhere in history?
Well, Richard Nixon had, as his attorney general, Mitchell, who was a bit of a handmaiden or lackey. And I'm afraid Barr is behaving that way. We're dealing with the Trump administration. It's the most scandal-plagued administration in U.S. history. It used to be Warren Harding people would talk about, and the Teapot Dome scandal and the like. But Donald Trump, love him or despise him or however you feel about him, you can't get around the fact that there's one scandal after another. Part of it is because he governs in an unorthodox way. You know, part P.T. Barnum and part and Buffalo Bill. There's George Wallace and Strom Thurmond and Lyndon LaRouche. And, you know, he's a composite of a lot of strands in American history, but he's a very unique person. And so I think years from now, this will be seen as an age of Trump, that he came in and kind of blew up the Republican Party and remodeled it to look like himself.
It's so interesting you name scandals, and people have been noting some of the different little things that happened over the past year. Forget impeachment. For instance, the Trump charity being shut down because of abuse of funds. I mean, that for any other president would have been the end. And it hardly is a headline. Look ahead, Douglas Brinkley. Your thoughts on 2020, the health of the Constitution going into the new year, the health of the country. Your thoughts?
Well, if I want to be upbeat, I could say this impeachment process is working because the founders put it first, it goes to Congress and you have to have 50%. That's not that high a bar. Anybody who's a majority can pretty much determine a 50, but they made it to actually remove a president 2/3, which is very, very hard to do. So one suspects Donald Trump is going to move forward out of the Senate trial and be fine. So the drama of the year, at least up until the summer, is going to be what happens in the Democratic Party. And it's worth noting that Joe Biden has been able to hang in there. He's constantly in the top of the polls. He's got many challengers, but we'll have to see and watch how he does. But when the Democrats meet in Milwaukee in 2020 for their convention, that'll be 100 years since women got the right to vote. And I would think the Democratic Party has to have a woman on its ticket, meaning if Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or or someone else, a male, got the nomination, I would think somebody like Senator Klobuchar would be in pretty good stead to be on a ticket, because I can't imagine the party wanting to be in Milwaukee with two white men leading it, because the Democrats are a party of diversity, and gender rights seems to be one of their strong suits.
Or, you know, to push that point even further, Klobuchar could pick Warren as her VP, or Warren could pick Klobuchar.
Yes.
Douglas Brinkley, his latest book is American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. He's a presidential historian at Rice University. Douglas, I say Happy New Year. I guess it depends on where you stand, whether or not it will be.
I'm determined to be an optimist, because the presidents that have been great, Theodore Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, you know, FDR, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, they all were optimists. You can't lead a country under a pall of pessimism.
Historian Douglas Brinkley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As many of you traveling back from the holiday are well aware, grabbing something to eat in the air can be rough. Think long-haul flights, short stopovers, chronic jet lag, limited choices, disorienting schedules. And for vegans, forget about it. When vegan Matthew Ayer started his career as a pilot a little while ago, he had trouble finding food, and that's when his alter ego, the Veggie Pilot, was born.
What's up, veggie people? It's your boy Matt, CEO of VeggiePilot.com, and I'm going to show you how to pack for a five-day trip with all your own food, all completely vegan. So we'll start here.
Matthew has help for you vegans or those just trying to eat a little healthier as you wend your way home. He joins us from L.A., where he's based. Matthew, how did this start?
It started, I swear to you, one day here in LAX. I wasn't even based here or living here or anything, but I went to one of the little restaurants in the airport on our little layover. And got a veggie sandwich, and it was white bread with this government cheese and sprouts and maybe a slither of avocado, and they charged me like $13. And I remember swearing to myself that I would never, ever pay money for such awful food again.
And also, so, when you were vegan, that cheese would have been a no-no. Let's explain to people. Vegetarian is, you know, non-meat,
sure.
But vegan, what can't you eat?
Vegan means no animal products whatsoever.
That really becomes a challenge. And so you started, first of all, bringing things in plastic bags, bringing things with you. What would you bring?
So I brought all kinds of crazy stuff because I was experimenting. One of my favorite things were these vegan meatballs. So I would bring a plastic bag full of spaghetti and another bag full of pasta sauce, and then one with these vegan meatballs, and I'd combine them on a plate and heat them in our little crew room at the airport. And I got a lot of looks doing that. Everyone was curious and kind of friendly about it, but it was pretty funny.
But you also had a feeling that you weren't the only one, that there were other pilots and flight attendants who had the same eating desires.
I knew there were. I mean, there's probably over 500,000 flight attendants in the U.S. And I was doing some research online to see, you know, I Googled vegan pilot. Nothing popped up. There was a forum for pilots on there where someone asked, is it possible even to be on a plant-based diet while being an airline pilot? And a couple people that said no, it would be too difficult. And meanwhile, I'd been doing it for 5 years at that point. So I wanted to build a website just as a landing page if someone were to Google vegan and pilot on there, just to say, hey, someone's out there doing it. It's possible.
Well, and now you have, you know, thousands of followers. And you also have found out, you know, times have changed, that many airports have terrific vegan restaurants. So do many cities. Throw out some airports that have restaurants that you recommend.
Sacramento Airport has this little restaurant called Freshy. Excellent vegan options. There's another restaurant in Oklahoma City at the airport, Cool Greens, I believe. Excellent vegan options there. Seattle Airport is, I think, dethroned Portland Airport as the king of vegan now. Portland's always been a great spot if you're vegan. They have lots of restaurants that have vegan options. And Portland Airport regulates the prices on the food, so the restaurants can't charge any more than they would at their restaurant in the city, so you can get a cheap vegan meal there.
You talk about the Red Cup in Oklahoma City?
I love this place. It's like this old house, Like, I call it the crazy vegan uncle's house, right? It's out in the woods. It's got this beautiful outdoor garden area, and there's a rooster that's just walking around, and they make these amazing Tex-Mex bowls or Santa Fe bowls. Usually it's with scrambled tofu, black beans. They put this excellent New Mexico-style green chili on top, and it's kind of buried in this place that you would think would be more of a carnivorous town.
Right. And this is the kind of thing that you put on your website, veggiepilot.com, this kind of information. But also, give us more tips for if you don't trust the airport and may not know the city or be able to get out into it, what can you bring with you now?
The big thing when you're traveling vegan, you have to think about what's going to be easily accessible to you. And the two things that are easily accessible are greens, right? Because you can go to any restaurant, get a salad, and just have them remove the non-vegan parts. And then the second part is carbohydrates, so you can get some rice or whatever else you need to keep you going. Now, the big problem is going to be vegan protein. So easy way around that is just pack yourself a nice, tasty vegan protein shake in a powder in a bag. You can bring this through TSA. All you need is a blender bottle to mix it with water, and you can make a shake. And when I travel internationally, like when I went to Tokyo, I was doing two of these a day. There are some great vegan spots in Tokyo, but for the most part, unless you're going to a vegan-specific restaurant, it can be tough to get that protein or anything like that. Yeah. Or you can bring protein bars if you're more comfortable with that. You know, the way I'm describing this makes it sound like, wow, it really sucks to be a vegan traveler. And while it is inconvenient at times, I like to say there's low lows, but then there's really high highs. You find that one vegan spot on your journey, and it is incredible.
That's Matthew Ayer, the Veggie Pilot, with social media sites that help guide vegan and vegetarian pilots and other travelers. We'll link you up at herenow.org. And he's also helping kids with food insecurities. Matt, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
And so what he's doing, Matthew told us that, yes, companies pay him to advertise products he approves of on his Instagram page, but the money he earns from those ads goes to help the Boys and Girls Clubs of L.A. Harbor. That's a passion of his. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. On this first day of the 2020s, that's so much easier to say than the aughts. Remember those? It's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Nearly 50 million people in the U.S. live with chronic pain. A National Geographic reporter dives deep into the latest on pain research, including sufferers wearing virtual reality goggles.
Other aspects of the virtual reality experience perhaps dominate, you know, the conscious experience, thereby lessening the pain.
Next time, Here and Now.